funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we need both night and day? Are there consequences to our modern ability to chase away darkness whenever and wherever it gets in the way of our plans? We tend to feel safer as streetlights and parking lots and gas stations grow ever brighter, as if artificial light is a kind of defense shield against crime. But cities and even suburban areas are now so bright that most of us have only seen a handful of the very brightest stars, and many of us have never seen the Milky Way. And my guest today worries that we are ignoring the consequences of all this unnatural illumination to our environment, our bodies, and even our souls. Paul Bogard teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University. His new book is called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What was your experience of night, or your most profound experience of night when you were a kid, and why do you think that had such a profound impact on you?
Well, I was really lucky. I grew up in Minneapolis, and we still have a family cabin about 3 hours north of the city. And when I was a kid, it was really, really dark, and it's still dark, but it's starting to show some of the effects that we're seeing everywhere. But I grew up with that firsthand experience of true darkness, of standing at the end of the dock, looking out over the lake, and seeing the Milky Way mirrored in the water, for example. And then I was lucky to have an experience when I was in Europe as an 18-year-old of being at the edge of the Sahara Desert in Morocco and having an experience of being in a place where there were no artificial lights in any direction as far as you could see, and having the sense, you know, as a good Minnesota boy, my first thought was that it was snowing when I came out. there were so many stars. I'd never seen stars like that, even at this cabin when I was a child.
There is something about seeing every star in the sky that breeds a kind of humility, that there is this incomprehensibly big universe beyond our whole world.
Yeah, I think there really is. I think it makes me feel, when I've had those experiences, it makes me feel both very humble, like I'm very, you know, small in the sense of, you know, when you look up and you see all those stars, and then when you realize that every star you're seeing is part of our galaxy, and beyond our galaxy are hundreds of billions of other galaxies that we're not even seeing, you can pretty quickly feel small. But I also think that for me, it makes me feel large in the sense of, you know, looking back down on the Earth and thinking, you know, this is our one planet. This is where we have the responsibility to take care of this. There's, you know, no other place to go, I like to say. The night sky makes it clear. You know, this is where we are. And so I think we can learn both humility but also a sense of responsibility for what we have.
You're candid here about the fact that you are somewhat afraid of the dark. And it's one of those, I mean, I think everybody is, right?
But... No, absolutely. It's a totally natural human emotion. I think people get a kick out of the fact that, you know, the guy who wrote the book on the importance of darkness admits to being afraid of the dark. But I think, you know, our fear of the dark is reflected in the way, though, that we use our lighting, which is to essentially try to rid the night of darkness. And I think we have a lot to learn about. It's not that I don't want folks to not fear the dark. It's just that I want folks to understand how important it is and to learn, as I have, a real respect for the darkness.
Yeah, it's almost like we don't trust our eyes at all. If there's light available, we turn it on full blast. But our eyes work better in the dark than maybe we have come to believe.
They really do, and I think, you know, so much of our attitude toward lighting and darkness is habit. It's what we're used to, and so, as you say, you know, instead of letting our eyes adjust, you know, the classic example is walking out. If you walk out in a relatively dark area with a flashlight, instead of, you know, letting your eyes adjust, and our eyes are just these amazing organs that really have great capacity to see at night, instead of letting them adjust, we immediately turn on the flashlight, which Yeah, it, you know, definitely helps you see better straight in front of you, but it erases everything that's around you, and it really cuts you off from what else there is out there in the darkness.
Yeah, suddenly your whole world becomes that little illuminated pool of light in front of you.
It's really true, you know, and the same idea works in terms of the way that we use light at night and thinking about safety. You know, if we're lighting some areas so brightly now that it creates these dark areas that are, you know, arguably more dangerous than, we're causing more danger than we're saving right now.
So how did our neighborhood start to get so bright? You know, it used to be that everybody had a porch light and that was pretty much it. And now there are a lot of neighborhoods where you could walk outside with a novel and wander the streets and not have to take too many breaks.
It's really true. And it comes from a real sort of mixture of different sources, you know, whether it's that those old porch lights or street lights or sports stadium lighting is very bright. Gas stations and parking lots now are lit a good 10 times as brightly as they were just 20 years ago. So there's been a real a combination of more of us, and so more lights, but then we're using light, we're using more light and brighter light. So all that mixed together has created this kind of soup of light around our metropolitan areas that we call light pollution.
And it's interesting that it's something that we don't notice all that often because we've just gotten out of the habit of looking up into the sky at night.
Yeah, we've fallen out of habit, you know, for ever since there were human beings, really, this experience of walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe was just the most common human experience. And it's gone from being the most common human experience to being one of the most rare human experiences. You know, it's only the few of us who really have that chance to be out and to see what it, you know, what everyone used to be able to see. And there are lots of different consequences, I think, for that.
There was a time when our lives were very much ruled by the cycles of day and night, the seasons, the fact that days were longer in some parts of the year and shorter in others. And now, anyone who is not sort of living directly off the land can pretend that those cycles don't exist at all.
Yeah, we really can. I mean, you know, just we turn on our lights and we just extend daylight into the darkness, essentially. And, you know, I think I always make a point of saying, and I really believe this, that artificial light, and we're talking especially now about electric light, is really wonderful. It's amazing. It brings so many benefits to us, you know, and this isn't about not having light at night. This is, you know, much more about we're using so much more light than we need, and we're using it in ways that are causing us problems that we're really not even aware of. And so I'm really talking about, and the folks that I talk to in the book we're just talking about using light responsibly and in ways that aren't harmful to us or to the environment.
Well, let's talk about harm to the environment because, I mean, people recognize that there is energy consumption, but the fact that there is a lot of ambient light in places that ordinarily would be dark has a pretty significant effect on the behavior of wildlife.
It really does, and I think a good place to start is just to acknowledge the fact that all life on Earth evolved in bright days and dark nights, and we need both. There's no species, no creature on Earth that's had the time, and this includes human beings, but has had the time needed to evolve to all this artificial light at night. So essentially, as one researcher at Harvard told me, we're running an enormous ongoing experiment on ourselves and on all the life around us. So when we talk about, you know, ecological effects, we're talking about the disruption of mating, foraging, migration patterns, all sorts of things that so many different species have evolved to absolutely depend on darkness for their living. And if we have heard about, say, habitat fragmentation, habitat destruction we're talking about daytime destruction, you know, a bulldozer going in and tearing down trees and that kind of thing. But light at night works in a very similar way to nocturnal species, to crepuscular species, those species that are active at dawn and dusk. When we turn on our lights, that's like a bulldozer. It's it's destroying their habitat, and they can't adjust.
So bats and birds and other things might be hunting in different locations because there's a big light that attracts insects, that sort of thing?
Absolutely, and that's, you know, a great example, and I'm sure, you know, most listeners have seen that experience maybe this time of year where there's a street light, or especially if it's a new light that's just gone in, and you get that, you look up and there's all those insects in the, you know, attracted to the light. And in this, what researchers have found is that initially that's kind of a bonanza for the predators. You know, they, all those insects are drawn to the light, and the predators really don't have to work as hard. They can just kind of swoop in and take choose from the buffet. But what happens is that over time, those lights act as a sort of vacuum in the ecosystem, and so they're drawing those insects out of the ecosystem, kind of like a vacuum, just sucking them out. And after a while, you start to see fewer and fewer of those insects at that light, and has a ripple effect going up the food system, or up the food chain, excuse me.
So in other words, that bonanza means that there's not enough food a year from now or 2 years from now because you have had more destroyed early on.
Absolutely, right. It has that long-term effect is really dangerous to the ecosystem.
Could bright places that animals, nocturnal animals, are experiencing right now ultimately affect the way they're evolving and their suitability for the conditions in which they live?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it makes some sense to me. I don't think I know of any studies that have shown that. It reminds me of one study, though, related back to human. We were talking about the eyes a little bit earlier, and I've heard a couple researchers talk about the fact that in major metropolitan areas now, in the States, in Europe, even in Asia and other places, where the human eye never goes to what we call night vision, never switches to that night vision, that it may start to actually affect the physiology of the eye because it's never being asked to do this function that it has done forever. So we might be able to extrapolate that back on the ecosystem and specific species, but I don't know of any specific research that's started to show that yet.
It's also interesting that, again, I'm not arguing either that we shouldn't have artificial light, but all of this light means that we're sort of never freed from jobs that can get done at any time of the day if you have suitable illumination. So in other words, it's sort of harder to turn off from some of the work we're doing than it used to be.
Well, absolutely. And such a rich subject, such a good question. I mean, we could talk about how more and more of us are working the night shift or partly at night, and the really serious human health effects that have been linked to the night shift, such as the World Health Organization citing the night shift as a probable carcinogen now at this point.
Just working overnights is likely to raise the possibility that you will develop cancer.
Exactly. And it seems to be if you do it long enough, you know, it's not going to happen if you take a shift this weekend or if you work it for a season or something like that. But lots of folks do it year after year. And it's because all that light is disrupting our circadian rhythms. It's impeding our sleep. It's getting in the way of the production of the hormone melatonin, all these vital functions that the human body needs, that we need for real health.
Paul Bogard is my guest. He teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University, and he's author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. We'd love to hear from you on this. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University. Paul Bogard's new book is called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Paul, how could there be a relationship between artificial light, say, working the night shift, and a problem like obesity?
Well, a couple different things. Number one, what I found is that when folks are up working all night, their meal times are kind of all over the place. And I spent time with night shift janitors and nurses in the emergency room, and I heard from all these folks that, you know, when do you eat? If we're really busy, we got just kind of grab a snack, a bag of chips on the go, or, you know, if it's not so busy, we're kind of sitting around munching. And the other thing is that our bodies just have not evolved to metabolize food in the middle of the night in the same way that they do during the day. So as one of the Harvard researchers explained to me, you know, if you have a pizza at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's much better for you than if you have a pizza at 3 o'clock in the morning. That we're just not set up to causes all sorts of problems with insulin and that kind of thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to David in Aubrey. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for the call, taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to contribute, in case Paul hadn't ever been at sea, that there is still a whole lot of the planet that's available to enjoy the night.
Mm-hmm.
All you need is a small boat and get about 50 miles offshore, and you can enjoy the whole of the night. And it's a great experience, and I kind of like to focus on that rather than all the terrible things we're experiencing because there's light.
David, tell us about what you've seen when you've been out there on the water. What does the sky look like?
Well, of course, it depends on the location and the weather, but on the clear nights, it's almost as if you could read without a moonlight. You have no trouble at all seeing the dimensions of the boat and the wheel and the sails above.
Hmm.
Of course, this is all on a small boat where you sit in the cockpit, not in a wheelhouse looking out of windows.
Right.
And it's as if you were taking a walk out there.
Thank you.
And of course, the silence and the lack of people. I have a theory that you can, if you close your eyes and people would place you in the midst of a lot of people with silence, you'd know they were there.
Hmm.
And the same thing's true when you're out in the ocean. You know you're alone, and it's a great feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for your call. What a wonderful description of that experience, don't you think, Paul?
Oh, it's fantastic, and I haven't spent a lot of time at sea, but I have spent a lot of time lying back in a canoe on a Minnesota lake, and I've had a similar kind of experience. But the other point I would make about your caller, and he makes a wonderful point about this, but in the book I really wanted to focus on the night that and the darkness that most of us experience, and that is accessible to most of us. And I think that it was never my intention to travel the world and try to find the most remote, most dark, you know, place. But it was always to focus on what's the kind of night that most of us experience and why is darkness important there? Where can most of us get to? So that was really my focus.
It's funny. I don't know if you if they have these where you live, but the new fad here are these like things called sensory deprivation tanks. Have you heard of those?
Mm-hmm. I have heard of them. Yeah.
And it's interesting because essentially what you're doing is sort of recreating that experience that that we just heard described on the phone. This idea that you're sort of floating there and looking out and not being exposed to light and noise, but in those cases, of course, you don't have the benefit of the beautiful starlight.
Right, exactly. I loved your caller makes such a nice call, and I think the experience he's describing again is the experience that used to be such a common experience that everybody would know exactly what he's talking about. And my guess is that if you asked 100 Americans if they'd experienced what he just described, you'd probably have two or three who've experienced that. And my guess is of those two or three or five, whatever it is, that most of them are older than 50. It's, you know, the people who are younger have grown up surrounded by light and by and large have not had the good fortune to experience this experience.
Well, I don't think anybody woke up and said, okay, let's destroy the darkness of night.
Right.
And you mentioned, you know, things are 10 times brighter than they used to be even 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. How did this creep up on us, and how do we start to turn it in the other direction?
Well, again, I think a lot of different reasons that it crept up on us, you know, just the continuing expansion of our human population and where we tend to go, we tend to bring our light. Using lights that are polluting, that are not shielded, and so we're using more light, and we're using more light that's spraying all over the place rather than using controlled light. And I think that points to what we can do about it, because one of the reasons I love this subject and I love talking about this subject is because it is not only a serious problem that I would hope folks would start to become aware of, but it's also something that we can so readily do something about. We can so readily attack this problem of light pollution. And again, I'm not saying, you know, let's turn out all the lights. I'm saying let's use light responsibly. And the first step toward that is simply, as I say, shielding our lights. Instead of allowing light to spray straight into the sky or glare into our eyes as we're driving, or you know, lots of us live in places where our neighbors' lights are shining into our bedroom at night. You know, let's shield those lights so they're only lighting the street that we want, or the sidewalk that we want, or the property that we want lit.
Yeah, that's a great point, because a lot of energy gets wasted if you have a light that, you know, at least half of what is being illuminated is going straight up into the sky rather than sort of being directed towards something on the ground.
Well, it really is, and I think, you know, if we've become aware of a lot of us of things like wasted water. So if you're walking down a street and you see a fire hydrant that's, you know, shooting water straight into the sky, you're going to probably call somebody and say, hey, there's, you know, water shooting all over the place. But we're just so used to all this light that we don't think it's anything out of the ordinary. And so we don't call anybody. We don't, you know, talk to our neighbor. We're just not aware of the problems that it's causing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Ellen who writes, my husband and I have visited Big Bend National Park many times and love to see the stars outside from there. We've gone to the McDonald Observatory and learned about an enormous tomato farm nearby that's causing great light pollution for the observatory and ongoing experiments there. The farm runs 24/7 and can be seen from miles away by road, not to mention the light that, of course, travels up.
Wow. Yeah, actually, so on the positive side, Big Bend is one of the most wonderful places to see a dark night sky in the States. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the national park system and how national parks are doing really good work to preserve darkness. And Big Bend is cited again and again as one of those real wonderful places that's not too far away for folks in your listening area, for example. But then the story about the farm that's going on all night long is just an all too common story that I hear again and again, and that again, that my guess is that tomato farm is using lights that are not shielded, that are, you know, allowed to spray all over, rather than controlled light that is, you know, thoughtfully and responsibly used.
Talk about the national parks a little bit, because there are hikes that are planned at night. It sounds like on the one hand they want people to enjoy what they have to offer at the park, and on the other hand they just want people to recognize that the night can be an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful new movement in the national park system that I guess started about 10 years ago, and there is now what's called the Night Sky Team as part of the Park Service, where they are tasked with traveling to all the different national park areas and measuring the darkness there as a way of cataloging kind of what level of darkness is now, as a way of saying, let's try to keep it here, or let's try to, you know, make it better, let's not let it get any worse. And along with that, more and more parks are offering nighttime activities. So as you mentioned, hikes or star parties where amateur astronomers come in and show folks the stars, and talks, that kind of thing. And I talked to a few different rangers who said, you know, they love that this part of their job, because so often they have people come in and say, you know, I've never experienced something like this, and it's so wonderful, and I can't wait to get back to where I live and start telling people about it. Hmm. And I think that's, you know, that's the way that we'll, you know, to go along with things like shielding our lights. I think it's just spreading the word about what we're missing and some of the other costs that we're incurring.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hey, Paul.
Hi. Hey, a couple of things. The experience that we've had at Caddo Lake out in the middle of the swamp was so glorious. It was the light, whatever there was, the stars reflecting off the surface of the water, and the water there tends to have some depth in that one can see the bottom of the lake, and it's really magnificent. I'm not suggesting that it's comparable to the Big Bend or such, but then my question, which you all have touched on really a couple of times, and that is city lights spraying up into the sky, and we don't see the stars. I was wondering how successful you know of the Tucson experience. Tucson is a city code, and I gather the metro area, which now has a population of about 1 million, they endeavor to, I gather, paint the top and have lights downward and as little approaching nothing as possible upward. Would you speak to that, please?
Thanks for your call, Paul.
Sure, absolutely. And I love Paul's use of the word glorious in terms of that experience, and also that, you know, It's great to go to places like Big Bend that are a little bit exotic, but there are also closer places that aren't, you know, primitive darkness, but they're still dark, and I encourage folks to get out into those areas. To the Tucson point, it's a great one. Yes, Tucson, Arizona, a modern American, very large city, has what we call a lighting ordinance that has done really wonderful work to keep the level of light in the city lower. Flagstaff, Arizona, has a similar thing, as do some smaller cities around the country and in Europe as well. The one point I'd make about that is that, I guess number one, it's an ongoing battle. The pressure is always there of more and more lights, and the folks that care about these things really have to stay on their guard. But the other thing is that, as a friend of mine in Flagstaff said, he's really proud to live in Flagstaff, where they have an ordinance, and proud of the citizens that, you know, are happy to live there and happy to have lower lighting levels. But he's always just a little bit concerned when people say, yeah, we have the lights low because of the astronomers, you know. And he says that's akin to saying we're protecting the Grand Canyon for the geologists, you know, so they can study the rocks. And his point, I think, is a good one, which is that the night is for all of us, and the night sky is for all of us, and that we all, this is, you know, part of our birthright as human beings is to experience the glorious night sky like your caller talked about.
You know, when you think about doing anything official with ordinances to try to cut down on light pollution, there's always, you know, you can hear the counter arguments on the other side, like, oh, we have so many bigger things to worry about. This is such a minor thing, and let's worry about this after we've solved every other possible problem. But I guess on the flip side of that is the fact that, as you point out, this is not a really hard problem to solve as long as you can get the political will up to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I get a kick out of that that reasoning, you know. So we shouldn't do the easy stuff until we get the hard stuff done, you know. It's like, why don't we do the easy stuff, and then, you know, we'll build on the hard stuff. And I think this is an issue that is such a win-win-win issue. It saves us money. It's good for our health. It's good for the health of the ecosystems that we rely on. It's actually, you know, good lighting, and by that I mean shielded, even lighting is actually safer at night than the kind of lighting we have in most places now, which is just kind of glare and bright lights in all directions that's, you know, making it hard for us to see and casting shadows. And So there really are very few of us who benefit from the way that we're using light now and who wouldn't benefit from using light in a more thoughtful way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to David in Mesquite. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you all today?
Great, thank you.
Good. I'm really enjoying this talk today, and I just wanted to share a couple experiences. When I was a kid growing up, I would always go down to my grandparents' farm in South Texas, and one of our fondest memories is my grandmother would put a quilt out in the yard, and we would lay on the quilt and just look at the stars and look for satellites, you know. Mm-hmm. And I try to explain it to my children nowadays, and they have no clue because they can't do that. And it's really, really sad, mm-hmm. you know, to a certain extent, you know. My other one, your guest was talking about the national park and night classes. We went to a big, not Big Bend, we went to Grand Canyon back during spring break in March of this year, hiked down to Phantom Ranch, and one of the most enjoyable talks we had was a night talk, mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, it was pitch dark, and the ranger did a great talk about the animals, about how they use the available light to live, and showed us the stars, you know, and we got to walk down to the Colorado River and just see the glory of the Milky Way galaxy from one end of the canyon all the way to the other. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful.
Do you want to comment on that? We have a few seconds before we go to break, Paul.
Sure, I was just going to say, I love the fact that he's talking about his kids, and that's one of the biggest losses that I think and write about in the book, is just that this experience that so many children are growing up without ever having this experience of the Milky Way, and I think huge costs with that.
Yeah, we end up buying them software so that they can see it on their computer rather than taking them outside and showing them.
Exactly.
Paul Bogard is with us. He teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University, and he's the author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. You can be part of this conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Bogard. He teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University, and he has a new book out called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want you to talk a little, Paul, about the way that we know the sky has inspired artists and writers and great thinkers for so many generations until the past few, when it's become harder and harder to see the sky.
Well, sure. I mean, I think when we think of this experience, this common human experience of walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe, it has inspired science in the form of astronomy, for example. It has inspired philosophy, spirituality, religion, and definitely art. And you know, I one of the things I do in the book is go to take a look at Vincent van Gogh's famous Starry Night painting. Mm-hmm. And I talk about how, you know, it's so popular, and 50 million people go to MoMA to take a look at it, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and people love it, and it's on refrigerator magnets all over the country. And I think when people look at it, they think, well, you know, it's beautiful, but, you know, Van Gogh was crazy, and that's kind of why we, you know, he painted this like he did. And I think that, you know, Van Gogh had his problems, but he was also living at a time when the experience of the night sky was so different from what we're experiencing, that I think you talk about inspiration and how I don't think the sky directly looked like, it's not a photograph of what he saw, but he was inspired by what he saw. And I always think, you know, going back to the earlier caller and so many children growing up without this experience, I just wonder how many, you know, young Van Goghs that are out there, or musicians or any kind of artists who are not having the chance to be inspired by this experience anymore.
And we know from studying Van Gogh's life that he didn't do his painting far from where he lived. It wasn't like he was going, you know, 300 miles away from home and looking at the sky and going back and painting. Talk about this thing called the Bortle scale and what it tells us about the relative light and darkness that we're able to experience today.
Sure. The Bortle scale was designed by an amateur astronomer about 12 years ago. He's from upstate New York, and he was tired of younger astronomers asking him to come out to a new place because it was so dark out there. And he would go out there, and he would, you know, say, well, it's dark, but it's not really that dark, and it's certainly not as dark as it used to be. And he began to realize that especially these younger folks had never really experienced real darkness. So he came up with this 9-point scale that starts at 9 and works its way down to 1, and 9 would be our brightest places. So in the book, I go to Las Vegas and I go to Times Square, but sort of any major downtown metropolitan area in the States or around the world would rank a 9 or maybe an 8. And all the way down to a 1, which is the kind of darkness that I talked about at the beginning of the show today, that sort of at the edge of the Sahara desert experience where I felt like it was snowing because there just was no artificial light anywhere. And that used to be, again, such a common experience. And now people would debate if there even are any places that would rank a 1 in the lower 48. And one other thing I'd say about the Bortle scale and the scale from 9 to 1 is that most Americans, most of us live most of our lives in what we think of as quote-unquote darkness, but it's darkness that would be about a 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9 on the scale. So most of us just never or very seldom are in areas that would be any darker than about in the middle of the scale.
My daughter said to me a couple of weeks ago, remember when we went on that vacation to Arizona so we could see the Milky Way? And of course, we did see it, and we enjoyed it every night that we were there, but it's above us here in Texas. We just have no way to see it.
Yeah, and you know, there are some good places in Texas, but again, you know, if you're an American living in a city, and even, unfortunately, even a small city or a suburb, you're not seeing the Milky Way at night. And one of the estimates I ran across while writing the book is that now about 8 out of 10 kids born in the U.S. today will never live where they can see the Milky Way. So we're raising a whole generation of children who have just never had this experience or very seldom had it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Just a quick comment about your seafaring listener. It's dark out in the middle of the sea, but you'll never find a boat stable enough to put a telescope on it.
Hmm. Something to think about.
It is, and I mean, when I started to set up the book, I had the idea to go to sea to maybe, you know, take an ocean liner, for example, maybe across the ocean, and I very quickly found out that, you know, those boats don't turn out their lights at night either. It's
right.
Kind of no different from where we live on land.
Hmm. We have an email here from John in Sherman who says, can you comment on the concerns about more unnatural sources of artificial light that are finally getting some critical attention, as in blue LED light?
Sure, absolutely. I'm glad to have the comment. So more and more municipalities are moving to LEDs, especially in their streetlights, but in other places, and that may be the case in Dallas-Fort Worth as well. On one hand, LEDs represent really great possibilities in terms of some of the challenges that I'm talking about in the book, because they can be their light can be more easily directed down to what we want lit and controlled. They can be controlled by computers, so you can, you know, easily turn them down at certain hours of the night if you want to. And yet they also present potentially greater peril, because especially the LEDs that most places are beginning to use now contain this blue light. They're called a blue rich white light. So they tend to be brighter for one thing, and they also contain a lot of this blue light, which on the spectrum of light is the most troubling for human beings and for ecology, because if you think about what blue light means to us as creatures, as species, and to life on Earth, blue light means daytime. It means wake up. It means, now it's not night anymore. It's time to do your daytime thing. And so when we're using these new LEDs that are heavy in this light, you can see how it would be confusing to any species that's out there. So the people that I talk to, they're kind of like, LEDs could be really positive, but they right now, at least the ones we're using, they're scared about what's happening.
Even in terms of things like getting sleepy at night, if we're staring at a computer or if we're in a room that is brightly lit with certain color temperatures, it's harder to signal to our bodies that it's nighttime and soon we must go to sleep.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, more and more of us are staring at a screen. And again, talk about blue light. A computer screen or a tablet or a TV screen, this is a lot of blue light coming into your body telling it to wake up, wake up, wake up. And then we wonder why we're having trouble falling asleep, when we turn out the light. And the fact is, some folks don't even turn out the light and they try to sleep, or they have light coming in their house either from, their neighbor next door, or they've left a nightlight on. And all that light is signaling, again, to your body, daytime. It's time to do stuff. It's not time for sleep. And this is confusing to us.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ben on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hey, go right ahead, please.
I just wanted to comment a little bit and ask your opinion about, it seems to me that people have a real false sense of security revolving, around lights. And I think that light solves all kinds of security issues. And from my perspective, it almost always makes things worse because of the way people misuse it. In other words, the bright lights cause very dark shadows, and the dark shadows, it seems to me, are much worse than not having the light at all, or having a very diffused light source.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, no, it's a great question, a great comment, and I'm glad to have it. I think that, what I would say about light at night and security and safety and darkness is that it's a complex subject, and too often we reduce it to a simple subject, which is light equals safety, darkness equals danger. And you don't have to think about it too long before you start to see how that equation starts to fall apart. If you have lights that are unshielded, so they're shining in all directions, they're casting glare into your eyes, they're making it harder for you to see, how is that making you safer? I mean, that almost by definition is making it more difficult for you to be safe at night. And as a caller suggested too, bright lights cast shadows where the bad guys can hide, and just on down the list. Again, I'm not saying we shouldn't have lights. I'm not saying that that light can't help us be safer. But this idea that, because some light helps make us safer, that more light will automatically make us even more safer, that's where the equation falls apart, and where I think if we really step back and think about this thoughtfully, we can do a much better job of using our light at night.
So this book is much more a sort of contemplation on the whole subject. But if you had to sort of offer practical advice to people who are headed out to the hardware store tonight or this afternoon, what would you say they should have for their homes that will provide sufficient lighting in necessary places but not overdo it and make the neighborhood look like a landing strip?
Exactly. Well, the funny thing is, and next time your listeners are in a home improvement store, they could go to the lighting section and notice this. Most of the lights that we put on our houses, for example, are designed to look good during the day.
Sure.
And so, we buy these decorative lamps that they look great during the daytime, and then we turn them on and we go upstairs and we fall asleep. And meanwhile, for most of these fixtures are shooting light in all directions, causing all these problems that we're talking about. And I would say that this is beginning to change because people are becoming more aware of it. People can do a number of things. They can turn off their lights at night when they go to bed, or turn off some of their lights. They can buy fixtures that are shielded. They can buy shields and put them on their existing fixtures. And I would just put a plug in for Lowe's, which is the home department store that now has a line of lights called Good Neighbor Lighting that is dark sky friendly lighting that's designed to do all the things that we're talking about here. And I love the title, Good Neighbor. You know, this is, you know, there's so many good reasons. It's a win-win-win issue. But one of them is that when your light is shining onto your neighbor's property, that's what we call light trespass. So your light is trespassing on their property, and to be a good neighbor would mean contain your light on your property. So these fixtures that Lowe's is selling now offer people a chance to do that.
You know, it's funny. I have a neighbor behind the house, kind of across the alley, with a light up in a tree that must be 40 feet high. And I don't think anybody else on the block needs a light because that thing is everywhere. And then it also seems there's a kind of peer pressure because once one neighbor puts one of those in, somebody else either thinks, that looks good, or what's wrong with my tree? And pretty soon, everybody's got that.
Right. That's exactly what's happened with, you know, gas stations and parking lots, is that, you know, the gas station on the corner got brighter, so the one on the other corner thought, well, we better get brighter too, or people won't come buy our gas. And it has nothing or very little to do with safety and security, and everything to do with selling you something. And I think that, you know, in the neighborhood example, you know, if I would just hope that folks could become aware of the value of darkness and to step back and think, now, do we really need that light? Do we really need that light as it is? Is there a way that we could achieve the lighting goals that we want in a way that doesn't light up the whole neighborhood and rob my neighbor's children of the view of the stars, that kind of thing? I don't think it's asking too much to just step back and say, are we using light intelligently, thoughtfully?
How much time do you spend outside every night if you can?
Well, I have a bird dog. I have a Brittany, and so we go out every night before bed and go for a walk. So wherever I've lived, I go out and we go for a long walk at night. And I just, again, you know, it's one thing to go to a real remote area and experience night there, and I think that's fantastic. It's a great experience, but it's this every night experience of nighttime and darkness that I find so beautiful, just being out in the neighborhood or out in the fields or what have you. And probably, you know, I try to get out for an hour at night every night and just enjoy it, if not more.
Paul Bogard teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University. His new book is called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. If you want to send along a comment, question, or suggestion, email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.